A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to episode 3 of British Invaders. This is the podcast where we talk all about British science fiction television, and today we will be talking about Doctor Who. This is Brian from Winnipeg.
And I'm Xander from London, England.
Doctor Who is a classic series that ran for many years. It started in 1963, and it was about a time traveler known only as the Doctor, who was clearly not from Earth, and traveled in a time machine called the TARDIS, and always traveled with one or two or three traveling companions. In each serial in the series, the Doctor would go somewhere with his companions, sometimes new companions would join him, and they would participate in some kind of adventure on Earth or on some other planet in any different time period, sometimes in history or in the future, or on a planet that has nothing to do with Earth.
As the series progressed over the years, it built up its own internal history, I guess you call it, and there were some major features added as the thing went on. The main feature is that when the first actor that played Doctor Who left, the team who made it had a bit of a quandary, and they decided to invent the concept of regeneration to cover the fact that the Doctor would stay alive, but would have a different actor playing him. And the in-story logic of this is that his body regenerates and he's the same person, but he appears different and behaves differently as well, in fact. And the other thing that was added later in 1969 was the fact that the Doctor was actually a renegade Time Lord. I think initially they didn't really describe what a Time Lord was, but again, over the series that was expanded upon, and the whole history of the Time Lords and how they ran their planet and the various things that they got up to were expanded on in various stories as time went on.
The TARDIS is a ship that travels through time. It stands for Time and Relative Dimensions in Space, and it is camouflaged with something called the Chameleon Circuit. And when the Doctor originally arrived in London in 1963, it was camouflaged as a police telephone box. The problem was that his chameleon circuit jammed, stopped working, and throughout the series, the Doctor was traveling in what looks to be a police telephone box, even though it can travel through space, go to different planets, and travel all through time. It does this by dematerializing into nothing, and sometime later, from the character's point of view, it rematerializes in another place and often another time. The TARDIS, as I said, was a police telephone box, which looks like a large blue telephone booth with no windows on it. And when Doctor Who was introduced, police telephone boxes were in fact common in England, and they did look like that. A police telephone box was something that you used to call the police. At the time, not everyone had telephones in their houses, so on street corners they would have these police boxes that would allow you to phone the police. And this was a well-known visual in England that was picked up for Doctor Who, and it became the identifying image for Doctor Who throughout the series. And it was also conceptually something that held it together, because this ship, this way of traveling through time and through space, was there throughout the series, and it didn't change that much. Most other things changed tremendously through Doctor Who from beginning to end, but the TARDIS, both visually and in concept, was really the same.
The interior of the TARDIS has changed over the years, although they tend to keep the same iconography on the interior that the original set had back in 1963. But in fact, up until in the 80s, the interior of the TARDIS wasn't that different from the original set back in 1963. In fact, it was quite a well-designed, futuristic set that it didn't date too much, which is always very difficult when you're trying to make something futuristic. It often looks very odd as time goes on. in the story, they can explain this, that, as I think Brian pointed out, the TARDIS is much bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, and it has this ability to reconfigure the interior space as well. In story, they do sometimes explain the fact that the control room has changed, or they're even using an alternative control room in some stories.
But the control room was always a large room with many sides that had that console in the middle that was mounted on a pillar and also had several sides around it.
Yeah.
It was a pretty novel design when it was introduced in the 1960s, I think.
Doctor Who was invented as a kids and family TV show on the BBC on Saturday afternoons. And it really took off in the UK with the second story, which was The Daleks. And these were instantly a hit with kids and I guess with adults as well. And I think its audience in the UK took off from there. And it was a staple of British television throughout its run. And a large percentage of the population watched it.
It also supported a large fan base with magazines that were available and conventions and so on. And the audience in North America and some other places was considerably smaller, but there was certainly a dedicated fan base in North America and other places as well. It should be noted that I think Doctor Who is really part of British culture. In the way that most everyone is aware of Doctor Who, the closest thing to it for Americans that I could suggest would be that Star Trek is a bit like it in terms of being built into the culture. If you go to a random person in the US and mention Captain James T. Kirk or Starship Enterprise, they know what you're talking about because Star Trek is just something people know about, even if they're not into science fiction. And in the UK, there's something similar where if you say the word TARDIS or Dalek, people know what you're talking about because it's something that is that widely known. It really isn't in North America, but it really is very well known and something that's just absorbed into the culture in the UK.
And when things happen on it, it's news in the tabloid papers, like when an actor changes and that sort of thing that a newspaper might try and get as a scoop. So it's, you can tell they think it sells newspapers, which shows how popular it is in the consciousness in the UK.
Yeah, it isn't like in North America where Doctor Who is just some small backwater show that some people know about and some people don't. It's much bigger than that.
Too late, Perry. Going soon. It's time to say goodbye.
Don't give up. You can't leave me now.
I might regenerate. I don't know. Feels different this time.
Doctor?
You're expecting someone else?
I...
That's three eyes in one breath. Makes you sound a rather egotistical young lady.
What's happened?
Change, my dear.
Doctor Who has a long history that started in the early 60s, in 1963, when it was introduced on the BBC. It was created by a fellow Canadian, actually, called Sidney Newman, and it was originally intended to be a show for children that would have something of an educational aspect to it, but it was not being produced by the children's television division of BBC, it was by the drama department. And part of what that meant is that it was not exclusively for children. It was never exclusively for children. It was really a whole family kind of show and worked rather well in that way. The original actor who played the Doctor was William Hartnell, and he played a sort of older grandfather-type character, and he was the grandfather to Susan, to one of his companions. But he was something of a curmudgeon, and he was curious and looking to go into things, but he was always very cautious and telling people what they couldn't do and trying to avoid getting involved in things. He was a very sort of strict curmudgeon type of character. And that was really how things were introduced. He was quite mysterious. When Doctor Who was introduced, it was not explained who the Doctor was. He had this time machine, this TARDIS, and he was clearly not from Earth, but you didn't know where he was from why he was traveling around. It was pretty clear that he couldn't go home, but you didn't know why he couldn't go home. There was a lot that was left unsaid, and that was a very strong component of how things were done in the 60s, and especially with William Hartnell as the first Doctor. William Hartnell acted in the role for about 3 years, and at that point, William Hartnell was not doing quite as well. He was actually getting ill at that point. He had Alzheimer's and he was starting to have more difficulty with his roles. And they turned the role over to Patrick Troughton, who played quite a different character as the Doctor. It was quite notable that at the beginning, when they introduced regeneration, that the character changed, not just what he looked like. And Patrick Troughton was sometimes called the Cosmic Hobo. He was a character who was very smart, but liked to play dumb a lot, and was a little bit disheveled and sort of ran around and ran away a lot, and took on quite a different type of character. He was younger than William Hartnell, and the grandfather type aspect was really no longer there. But he was still significantly older than the companions and many of the other characters there.
As Brian said, some of the stories were set in historical times, and these were definitely part of the original educational remit that Doctor Who was given when it was first set up. And in fact, the first ever story, apart from the pilot episode where Doctor Who is on Earth in contemporary 1963, they soon whiz off to prehistoric times with a bunch of cavemen or prehistoric men who are trying to rediscover fire to get them through apparently an ice age or some cold spell. And then they went to see the Daleks, which was in the future, and then they did a long story called Marco Polo, which was about the famous explorer Marco Polo, and another early story about the Aztecs. And these early stories, which were set in historical times, were basically the Doctor and his companions got caught up in historical events and met historical people. But one thing that soon came clear was that they couldn't change history. And in his early stories, there was no alien invasion or influence or alien artifacts involved. In later stories, they did usually have some alien influence tied up with historical events, but not in the early ones.
They did the alien influence there more in the 70s and in the 80s. In the 60s, the historical stories were really just a historical adventure with our characters that we know, the Doctor and his companions, transplanted into that historical time. And there were some really fun stories. There were the ones that Xander mentioned. There was also a story about the Crusades. There was a story called The Highlanders that Patrick Troughton did that was set in historical Scotland. There were quite a few of these, and on the whole, they were quite well done. I quite enjoyed watching those.
I think he had the advantage that the BBC has always been quite good at doing historical dramas, and to do the historical science fiction, they could lever their expertise, so all the sets were well designed and the costumes, and I think that what helped some of these historical stories being some of the standout early stories.
And most of the actors had done other historical dramas as well.
Yeah, exactly. In the early 1970s, there was another change of actor playing the Doctor, and John Pertwee came in as a Doctor, and with him also Doctor Who started being made in colour. And the way John Pertwee played the role suited this new colour style. The programme became a bit like James Bond, really. It turned into much more of an action show, and John Pertwee's Doctor was very much an action hero. He did what he's called Venusian karate, and was very hands-on and would actually go mano a mano against the enemies rather than the previous Doctors, who very much used their intelligence and influence on other people to get around problems.
Which John Pertwee did as well.
He did, but he also used his hands as well. Mm-hmm. And the other key thing, partly as a cost-saving measure, I believe, was the Doctor being exiled on Earth. The Time Lords actually exiled the Doctor on Earth, which meant basically that for at least the early stories, John Pertwee's Doctor was stranded on Earth and all the stories were set on Earth, although they did actually move out that format over the time. And the other thing that was invented, it actually was in an earlier Pat Troughton story, was this organisation called UNIT, which was the United Nations Intelligence Task Force, which was a military unit, but it was an international military unit, and it was basically set up to combat these alien threats, which seemed to have the habit of trying to take over or invade the Earth. And a lot of the John Pertwee Earth-based stories basically featured the UNIT as sort of helpers to the Doctor. In fact, their way they solved things were opposed. Well, UNIT people basically wanted to kill all the aliens, whereas the Doctor was more into trying to negotiate a solution between the aliens and the humans, and often came to disagreement with the UNIT and its commander, the Brigadier.
It was a different format, and it actually worked quite well for those serials in the early 70s. When John Pertwee took over, there was a huge change in the feel of Doctor Who. You had not only a new Doctor, but as Xander mentioned, you had the series being shot in color instead of in black and white. You also had new companions. When Patrick Troughton left, both companions that were there before, Jamie and Zoe, both of them left, and we now had a completely new cast and a new look with color and quite a different feel to it with John Pertwee there. So it was really a significant change.
Yeah.
In the 1960s serials, the Doctor always had a companion who was a man who was younger than he was, who could do all of the more hands-on physical confrontations, and if one of the good guys had to get in a fight with someone, there was always a companion there who would be able to do that, because William Hartnell or Patrick Troughton would not do that. But with John Pertwee, there was no longer a male companion, and the Doctor would do that himself.
Yeah.
In the late 70s, in 1975, Tom Baker took over as the Doctor. And this was another significant shift. You had, instead of John Pertwee as the dashing, outgoing James Bond kind of Doctor, you had a much more of a bohemian wanderer who had big curly hair and prominent teeth, was known as Teeth and Curls sometimes. Tom Baker is, I think, by far the most famous of the Doctors, certainly of the original series, and he's well known for being tall and having the long scarf that trailed right down to the floor. And with Tom Baker, there was much more of a feeling of the Doctor being someone who was wandering around for the sake of wandering around without purpose, just to go and see things, and would always get caught up in adventures and help people and solve problems and things. But that was something that just happened by the way, because he was there. And that was a definite change. There was also, more than at any time before, the focus on alien worlds. And most of the Tom Baker stories, he was going off to some other world and it had nothing to do with Earth. But early on, the Doctor, as played by Tom Baker, said that he did not want to do the Brigadier's work for him. Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart was a constant part of the series in the early 70s with John Pertwee. He was almost always there, and the third Doctor, John Pertwee, was always fixing things for the Brigadier, always dealing with the alien problems.
The way Tom Baker played the Doctor did actually seem alien. The way he reacted to situations and the things he said made you realize this wasn't a human being. It was definitely an alien looking at human behavior and having his own weird skewed view on things, which made it quite interesting.
And that was probably the first time that we saw that since William Hartnell, the first Doctor.
Yeah, it did encompass, and I think all the actors have tried to do this, encompass parts of the way the previous actors played the part, because some of the humour and tomfoolery of Pat Troughton's Doctor was in Tom Baker's Doctor as well. Although they all are their own people, they do have parts of the previous incarnations, as you could call it.
That's true.
In 1981, Tom Baker eventually left after serving for a very long time, for 7 years. And he had really become established as the Doctor. And it was very hard. People envisioned someone else playing the role. But he chose to leave and the programme was still doing well. And the BBC had no intention to cancel the show at that stage. So they had to bring in another actor. And they brought in Peter Davison, who was a much younger actor. And he actually did have some history as a well-known actor in another show on the BBC called All Creatures Great and Small. And I think that was a deliberate choice, that he was a sort of known face that people could relate to. He had a quite friendly character in that other show. So I think that's part of the reason behind his casting. And he was, not only was he much younger, but he was a very less...
He was the least curmudgeonly of any of them.
Yeah. He was very human, I suppose you could say. He was very concerned about how people felt, and he showed a lot of concern for his companions, probably more so than the previous doctors who used to drag them around. And if they got into scrapes, well, that just happened. And okay, the doctor usually would rescue his companions from scrapes. They did treat them a bit as hangers-on who got in the way sometimes, whereas Peter Davison's doctor was very concerned about his companions and also about the people and aliens he met. So he's very empathic, I suppose you could say. And then he left...
3 years later.
3 years later, Peter Davison left being the Doctor, and Colin Baker was brought in. if we point out that Colin has no relation to Tom Baker. Colin Baker had actually played a small part as...
another Time Lord.
He was another Time Lord, he must have been, yes. As he was on one of the adventures set on the Time Lord planet Gallifrey. He actually shot Peter Davison's Doctor, in fact. And obviously the producer liked his acting and brought him back as the Doctor. Initially, his Doctor was more antagonistic, actually sort of a throwback to the first Doctor. I think one thing you should point out is that the Doctors, after regeneration, often their way they acted was a bit odd. Peter Davison was very weak when he first started, but then he sort of got stronger. And Colin Baker's Doctor was very nasty. You know, it was pretty nasty to the existing companion he had at the time. And he did mellow a bit with time, although in fact he was a more forceful Doctor than Peter Davison's Doctor throughout. Then, after two seasons, one of the executives in the BBC didn't like the way Doctor Who was going, and also its viewing figures were going down. And he basically put Doctor Who on a hiatus. Didn't cancel it, but rested the show, thinking that it needed revamping. And one of the things he laid down was that if it was brought back, it wouldn't have Colin Baker as the Doctor. So that was sort of forced on the production team by one of the BBC executives. And Sylvester McCoy was brought in, who was a more playful Doctor. And I guess he is a bit more like Pat Troughton's Doctor, you could say.
Absolutely.
And he served up until the series cancellation in 1989. And his Doctor was a bit hit and miss at the beginning, I think. It was getting into its stride at the end, and it had some pretty good stories towards the end.
There were some interesting things in the 1980s. The Sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, was interesting because his entire run, the hallmark of what happened for those two seasons, was the conflict between the Doctor and his companion, Perry. She came on when Peter Davison was still there, right near the end, and the Doctor, as played by Peter Davison, was always very nice and friendly, and she was just fine with that. And then all of a sudden, Colin Baker is there, and the two of them are in almost constant conflict. They're not always in conflict, but it was a very hard time for her, and he was very aggressive and nasty and curmudgeonly. And this was a big shift back from Peter Davison, so that was interesting.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Seb.
We host the UK's largest Doctor Who and Torchwood podcast, the DWO WhoCast.
It's a weekly show where we talk about all the Doctor Who and Torchwood related news and reviews.
And we have exclusive behind the scenes interviews with cast and crew.
So, if you're looking for a podcast where you're as much a part of the experience as the hosts,
then why not try out the DWO WhoCast at www.thewhocast.com or www.drwho-online.co.uk.
The DWO WhoCast, the Doctor Who and Torchwood podcast.
One of the hallmarks of Doctor Who is certainly regeneration. This is the process they use each time to switch from one actor to the next. And in fact, they went through seven different actors playing Doctor Who, which is not that many, seeing that the classic series with these seven Doctors lasted 26 seasons. Regeneration was certainly originally there to accommodate a change of actor, but it was used for more than that, because there was always a change in character, not just a change in appearance. The first regeneration they did, when William Hartnell was written out and Patrick Troughton became the second Doctor, the characters remarked almost immediately after the regeneration that he acted differently. It wasn't just his face, but he was a different kind of person. He was a different character. That really allows the Doctor to adapt over time. So the original curmudgeonly grandfather kind of character that the Doctor was great in 1963, 64, 65. By the time we were getting into 66, that wasn't really what was called for anymore. They wanted something with a little more humor, something that was a little more lighthearted than William Hartnell. And Patrick Troughton was brought in with a different type of character. And over time, they kept changing the Doctor to new actors, but to new types of characters. So the type of thing you would have in the early 70s versus what you'd have in the early 80s or the late 80s would always be quite different.
And the other thing that also changed along with the Doctor is the companions. The first Doctor had his granddaughter, Susan, as his companion, and a man and woman teacher that they picked up in the first episode. And as Brian talked about before, the man often played the role of the one who would get into fights and scrapes because the Doctor was an elderly character who wasn't capable of doing such things. And this was the model of the early stories, although the actual companions changed. The role of the young man was to do the sort of fisticuffs, and the women was really to be often to be captured by the aliens or the foes and to scream a lot, to be honest, and not do much more. But then as the series went on, the women became to reflect the times and became much more proactive. And with younger doctors, the need for the male companion reduced, and there were less male companions. There still were male companions. Even Tom Baker's Doctor did have a male companion for some time, but certainly the way the sort of dynamic worked was different. And the other thing towards the end happened that Tom Baker actually had another Time Lord, or Time Lady, as she was referred to sometimes, as a companion, which was Romana, who actually was played by two different actresses, in much the same way that the Doctor was changed, played by different actors.
There was a definite transition of the women becoming more capable as companions. The early companions in the 60s were always portrayed as being intelligent, but they were sort of weak and would definitely scream a lot and get captured and that sort of thing. And as they moved into the early 70s, you had the new types of companions. So you had people like Liz at the very beginning and Joe Grant and Sarah Jane Smith, who were characters who were portrayed as being more professional and more capable, and they would still get captured and scream a lot and so on. But they were much stronger characters and were much more competent. And then as you went into the late 70s, it went further down that route with companions like Leela and Romana, where Leela was a sort of female warrior character who carried a knife and attacked people a lot and didn't scream very much and was very much meant to be a stronger character. Romana, when she was introduced, she was the Time Lady that Xander mentioned. Romana was in many ways on an equal footing to the Doctor. She was still sort of in the back seat of the adventures, but she knew more or less as much as he did. The Doctor always knew just about everything, and the Doctor can do anything. But Romana knew just about as much as the Doctor did, and he was obviously more experienced and sometimes a little wiser in his decisions, but you had a companion who was much more on equal footing in many other ways. And it was definitely a hallmark of Doctor Who adapting to its time. And as you went into the 1980s, there were still different companions who had other types of things, and many of them did scream a lot, but you definitely had stronger characters than you had earlier for companions, certainly than you had in the 60s and the early 70s. The visual aspect of Doctor Who also adapted and evolved a lot over time. It started in black and white, and it was in black and white right through the 60s. In 1970, they really couldn't do black and white anymore. They couldn't get away with it, and they actually cut the length of the season in half in order to go to color programming. And there was a very different look once they were in color. The look and the feel, the visuals, the writing, all of these changed over time. In about 1985, soon after Colin Baker took over, the BBC realized that science fiction like Doctor Who really needed a little more budget. They started having somewhat better effects and better looking monsters and aliens and so on. By our standards today, they were certainly not great looking effects or anything like that, but there was certainly an improvement there. There was also a transition with how scary Doctor Who was allowed to be. Doctor Who was known for being scary for children. there have been legends about children watching from behind the sofa, and so on and so forth. In 1967, Tomb of the Cybermen came out, and this was very scary at the time, with a scene where these Cybermen frozen in a tomb were reanimated. That was pretty radical at the time, but what came later went further. In the early 70s, you had Terror of the Autons, where you had things like this little rubber ugly doll waking up and running around and attacking people, and all sorts of strange plastic things running around. Then by the mid-70s, you had things like the Pyramids of Mars, where you had mummies walking around and attacking people, and all sorts of things in that particular serial. There was some controversy in each of those cases about how scary they were making it, even though what they were doing in the 60s or 70s was certainly not as scary as what they were doing later in the 70s and later on.
There is actually a campaigner called Mary Whitehouse, who is famous or infamous in the UK, that she took it on herself to comment on the suitability of programming, especially for children, and Doctor Who was one of her targets, and certainly those episodes which Brian mentioned incurred her wrath that have been unsuitable for children. And there's, I mean, there's one incident in another episode called the Deadly Assassin, where Tom Baker's Doctor left an episode on a cliffhanger of his head being held underwater and apparently being drowned, and that was one of the ones that she had a great complaint about. So yes, the programme was controversial.
Doctor Who was eventually cancelled in 1989. What happened at the time was linked to the BBC realizing that a science fiction series needed a significant budget. And coming into the 90s, it was becoming clear that you needed to aim things for an international audience, and people were really interested in better effects and visuals that were a lot fancier and higher production values, and they couldn't really get away with what they had been doing. So the BBC decided to put its two science fiction series that it had to out-of-house productions, so others would produce their shows and they would air them. And for the other series, which was Red Dwarf, that was actually quite successful. For Doctor Who, it wasn't so successful, because it was such a complex series with new characters and monsters and aliens in each new serial, and new places and sets and everything. None of the British production houses that did this type of thing could afford to do a high production value version of Doctor Who. And eventually, the rights went to the United States. They went to Fox.
Another thing to point out with that the in 1989 that the viewing figures for Doctor Who were much lower than they had been at the height of Doctor Who, which was well over 10 million viewers it used to get in, say, the time of Tom Baker, whereas I think at the time at the end it was probably 3 or 4 million. As Brian has said, Fox bought the rights to make a TV movie starring a new Doctor, Paul McGann, in 1996. Although it was made in America, it was quite consistent with the BBC series in some ways. In fact, they did bring back Sylvester McCoy to reprise his role as the Doctor at the beginning of the show. And in fact, the regeneration of his Doctor into the Paul McGann Doctor was a major feature of sort of the beginning part of the TV movie. The TV movie, not surprisingly, as it was financed mainly by the Americans, was set in America, and the style was American style, I guess you'd say, although, as I say, it did try quite hard to be consistent with the BBC show, and that was screened in 1996. It did actually quite well in the UK. It got pretty good viewing figures, if I'm rightly, but the big problem was that it didn't get big figures in the States, and Fox, who would sort of made it as a one-off TV movie, didn't see enough in it to make it into a full series, so it didn't really go anywhere.
The movie with Paul McGann was a bit of a strange combination, because you had a lot of elements from the classic BBC series being brought in, but at the same time it was somehow merged with a different type of American series. And it felt a bit like I was watching some other American series that I didn't really want to see with a bunch of Doctor Who elements mixed into it. It was an odd mix. A lot of fans were disappointed and really didn't like that particular show.
I think some ways, some people say it actually tried too hard to be like the original Doctor Who. It might have worked better if it had been even more different.
So we are trying a new format where we are going to split each discussion into two episodes. So you will have two episodes of British Invaders each month instead of one episode. So if you like this format, let us know at britishinvaders@gmail.com, or you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. And we will be back with some more about Doctor Who in a couple of weeks.